Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Legalizing bed and breakfast units. In his State of the City address, Honolulu's mayor proposes to do just that. Is it the answer to our housing crisis? Housing advocates have their own ideas, and so do booking platforms like Airbnb.
The Hurricane Maria devastation of Puerto Rico has generated a massive rebuilding effort, along with a number of lessons about what it takes to rebuild an electrical grid. We'll hear from Blue Planet Energy's Chris Johnson.
And there's growing concern over e-cigs and the impact on young smokers. We check on the push to limit access to those under 21, as well as a move to make the University of Hawaii system tobacco-free.
It's April 4th, day one of our spring pledge drive. We'll have those conversations and a few more right after this news.
The failure of counties to enforce zoning codes has added to the state's housing crisis with a staggering number of runaway illegal vacation rentals. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell is proposing to try and fix that broken picture by legalizing bed and breakfast units, with operators paying higher taxes and higher penalties for violations. Caldwell wants to allow the units in apartment zone areas and to discourage their construction in single-family residential neighborhoods.
Short-term rentals, whether they're hosted, B&B, or unhosted, you're going to have to get a registration number from the Department of Planning and Permitting. And you're going to have to put that registration number on all your advertising product, whether it be social media, Airbnb, VRBO, or on handouts. It needs to be there. If it's a hosted bed and breakfast, you'll be permitted to do hosted B&Bs in residential, apartment zone districts, business districts, mixed-use districts, and all of Waikiki. If it's unhosted, meaning it's a whole home and the owner is not there, where we get the most complaints, you're only going to be able to do it in non-residential areas. And property taxes are going to change because you're not using your home just as your residence. It's a business, and in some cases, it's a hotel and resort. So for bed and breakfasts, your real property tax rate would go up from $3.50 for $1,000 in value to $6.45. And if it's unhosted, you have a mini hotel operating, then you're going to pay, instead of $350, you're going to pay $12.90 for $1,000 in value, just like hotels and resorts do in Waikiki and other parts of our island. So we have a bright line in terms of getting a registration number from Department of Planning and Permitting. And if you violate that, your fines start at $25,000 a day after 7 days and climb to $100,000 a day. And repeated violations after the third notice of violation, you have a lien placed on your property that can be executed on. The lien amount will be added to your real property taxes. You won't be able to renew or get a driver's license, so it'll be harder for you to travel unless you have a passport.
Now, the vacation rental issue is a touchy subject. Save Oahu's Neighborhoods has long advocated enforcement first before any legalization. A special task group looking at the measures to be taken up by the Planning Commission and the City Council is actually meeting this morning. The Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice recently compiled a report on the state of our housing based off other existing studies. Those studies show a majority of vacation rentals are owned by non-residents, and the vast majority are entire home rentals. In Hawaii, 1 in 24 homes are vacation rentals. On Kauai, it's 1 in 8. In Maui, it's 1 in 7 homes. We sat down with Appleseed policy analyst Madison DeLuca last week to talk about the group's growing concern over the lack of affordable housing inventory being lost to vacation rentals.
We took most of our information from reports produced either for or by different state agencies. As far as issues, we looked at the number of vacation rentals and how they were growing, how this affects Hawaii residents, and the economic effects on our state. The 23,000 vacation rentals exist in Hawaii right now, which we found really staggering. And this is a 35% increase from 2015. So this has grown pretty quickly. At this point, 1 in 24 housing units in Hawaii is a vacation rental, which we also found to be a really compelling figure. And as far as the impact that this is having on Hawaii residents, other research that we looked at showed that housing prices are increasing, or excuse me, rent is increasing at twice the rate of wages, and we have the highest rents in the nation. And our research suggests that part of this might be tied to the vacation rental issue.
What are you folks advocating for? What are you trying to flag?
Absolutely. We've included some recommendations in the report. These include, first of all, making it illegal to advertise an unpermitted vacation rental online. Currently, a vacation rental that's advertised without a permit online, that advertisement isn't proof that the unit is being rented illegally. So that's a start. Additionally, making it so that vacation rental platforms are mandated to either identify and or remove non-compliant listings from their sites. San Francisco had a similar requirement recently, and it's produced some really great effects. And finally, increasing the resources put towards enforcement in this state. In 2016, the city and county of Honolulu provided more resources to the Department of Permitting and Planning, and we think it would be great if the state continues to follow in this example.
We're in a housing crisis, and people have watched the rents go up and units that are being turned into vacation rentals, which maybe normally would have been in a rental pool for local families.
Absolutely. Like you were saying, raising the awareness. Something that really surprised me when I read about it was the study that was recently produced by San Francisco, which has a similar rental market to Honolulu. They found that for every housing unit removed from the housing market to serve as a vacation rental, there was up to $300,000 in negative economic impact in the city. And that even takes into account tax revenue that's brought by the vacation rental, the hosts, money they're making, increased visitor spending, taking all that into account, up to $300,000 of negative economic impact per rental. And that could be what's going on in Hawaii now or in the future if this isn't controlled.
Right. And I know both the city council and the state lawmakers have been looking at ways to try and get their arms around this problem. There's some discussion about not allowing vacation rentals for whole homes. Some discussion about allowing or legalizing bed and breakfasts so that the operator has to be there on premises. So lots of different things in play to figure out how to manage this.
Yeah, the whole homes issue that you bring up is one that we really looked at in the report. We found that up to 93% of vacation rentals are entire home or entire condo rentals. And in combination with the statistic that 52% of vacation rentals, at least in Hawaii, are owned by non-residents, taking those two things together suggests to us, at least, that what vacation rental platforms are pushing, this idea that vacation rental hosts are your friend or family member or neighbor renting out an extra room for some more income in their house, that that's not the case, that it's more of a commercial enterprise.
And we have heard our listeners call in to say, hey, this really does help me make ends meet, that with the high cost of living or if you're on a fixed income, it really does take the edge off, you know, whether you're going to be able to, you know, make your payments on your property. You know, it costs a lot to get a place, and then also, you know, can you maintain it? But then there's also the question, well, then where do you go if, let's say, you're forced to sell your home? Where do you go? And then you're kind of stuck in the rental market as well, competing with everybody else.
Of course, yeah.
I know there are certain neighborhoods that are particularly impacted. There was one organization, Save Oahu's Neighborhoods, that says really the North Shore, you know, Windward Oahu, those areas really impacted by vacation rentals.
Yeah, we looked at one study produced for the Hawaii Tourism Authority that broke down by zip code where the different amounts of vacation rentals per zip code. And there are certainly neighborhoods that we found have, they bear a disproportionate brunt of this issue.
That was Madison DeLuca of the Hoy Appleseed Center. Again, it recommends that the burden of vacation rentals not be unfairly placed on certain neighborhoods. It also advocates tougher enforcement. Critics of the report say the organization cherry-picked the data. Airbnb disagrees with some of the report's findings. The online booking company says it has helped residents stay in their homes. It also sees its business as critical to the state's economy, contributing millions of dollars every year. A House bill to allow Airbnb to collect taxes from its operators was passed by the Senate Ways and Means Committee just yesterday.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets in concert, the movie accompanied by live music, this Friday and Saturday at the Blaisdell, hisymphony.org.
You're back with The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico hard 6 months ago, all but destroying its electrical grid. As with Hawaii, Puerto Rico is a vulnerable island chain and a part of the volatile part of the ocean. Hurricanes there are a matter of if, not when. Chris Johnson, Chief Operations Officer of Blue Planet Energy, a Honolulu-based provider of off-grid energy storage systems, is just back from Puerto Rico, where his company has been aiding in the rebuilding of Puerto Rico's energy grid. He says it wouldn't make sense to rebuild the system that existed before the hurricane. There are lessons for Hawaii to be learned in Puerto Rico. And we spoke about the conditions his team faced there.
The port was totally overflowing with just backups and delays. If you can imagine driving around a downtown area with all the traffic lights out, there's a level of chaos that's there. And people are learning to adapt to it. I mean, I think decisions, everything just is kind of like even a little slower than Hawaii time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took us a little longer to get things done. We thought we were getting done. And it's still ongoing challenge. I mean, what the level of destruction and need for rebuild and uncertainty and even just the release of the insurance fund so people whose houses were flooded or destroyed can be rebuilt. I mean, all of that is taking ages in the life of people who are living without electricity or without water.
And you're saying they're kind of adapting to it?
I mean, we as humans are very adaptable, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they've absolutely made adaptations to this new existence.
One of the things that you folks have run into is some regulatory issues that I was kind of surprised to hear about.
Sure. So, you know, and part of this is as a part of the U.S., we are trying to use our government institutions to get support to Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there are certain rules in place that make that not necessarily as efficient with the goals that we're trying to accomplish in terms of rebuilding there. So we know that there were inefficiencies and problems in how the grid was constructed. I mean, that's why it's been down for so long and you know, in the face of this huge natural
mm-hmm.
disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if we rebuild it in the same way, we're going to have the same problems again. And so there's this need to reconceptualize and innovate, to leapfrog from where the grid was to where we want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that process is really hindered by both the uncertainty and the lack of experience and knowledge on the ground, as well as some of our own institutions.
If the grid were to be leapfrogged to where it needs to be, would it be that much less vulnerable to the next hurricane?
Sure. You know, and that's certainly what we want to achieve. I mean, hurricanes are extremely powerful natural forces, and there's, you know, it would be impossible to prevent all damage from them, but we can certainly make our grid more resilient,
mm-hmm.
which is the ability to get it back up and running after a disaster.
Mm.
We can also make it more reliable, which is just even in terms of today's, is the power going to be on? Are there going to be brownouts or blackouts today? So both of those can be improved in terms of how we rebuild the grid.
What kind of, I mean, this could happen in Hawaii, obviously. We're in a hurricane area. What kind of lessons can we take from Puerto Rico?
Great question. So, you know, when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, there were about 10,000 rooftop solar installations on the island. Most people didn't realize that their solar was not going to work when the grid went down. Because you think, I've got solar panels, I'm self-sufficient, the sun is shining, why wouldn't I be able to turn the lights on?
Yeah.
But as a safety precaution, those solar systems are prevented from being able to generate electricity if the grid's down, unless you can island your house, right? Unless there's a big switch that allows you to cut yourself off from the grid.
Island your house?
Yeah. So you know, it essentially be your own little energy island, right? So this is, you may hear the words of microgrid or nanogrid thrown around. So basically, you need to be able to be solely self-reliant. And if you can do that, and usually this is done in combination with energy storage, because once you have the energy storage combined with the renewable generation, you can be self-sufficient. You don't need the grid. You can use the grid as backup, or you can be totally independent of the grid.
Are Hawaii houses dependent on the grid to that same degree?
Very much so. And you know, with the early boom of solar in Hawaii, almost all these solar installations were rooftop, grid-tied installations, which means when the grid goes down, they won't work. Now there has been moved to really emphasize the need for storage integrated with the solar. So there is, and part of this is to alleviate the strain on the grid that the utility has been experiencing from this huge growth, because we're in a perfect place to have both the solar, but also because the electricity rates are so high. Puerto Rico has the second highest rates right after Hawaii.
So if you want to you use the term island as a verb, I've never heard it used that way. If you want to island your house, is that a pretty expensive conversion?
So, you know, and these are the types of things that we've been talking to a lot of builders, and we're telling them, build this in from the beginning. There's no reason not to.
Make it self-sufficiency.
Sure. And also, so you can do it in a number of ways. You know, retrofitting is more costly, but it's going to go along with other benefits you're trying to generate. You know, I think after the hurricanes, not only in Puerto Rico, but just how they impacted Florida and Georgia and Texas and the Carolinas and where they've been hitting, when people spend 2, 3, 4 days without power, all of a sudden the resiliency they could get from their own systems, the value that they place on that goes way up. So we're seeing a big increase in people who are wanting to do that because they say, I need to be self-sufficient. I can't rely on the utilities who have failed to maintain the grid, who have cut all these costs, and who just don't even have the equipment and manpower to be able to restore the grid when it goes down at a catastrophic level like this.
And a lot of cities, does this kind of situation prevail where the expansion of the city and the population is basically put too much strain on the grid so that it is that vulnerable that it's just not going to be able to get it back up and running in any kind of timely manner?
Well, so we've got, you know, when if you look at your electricity bill closely, usually you'll see it broken into three parts. The amount, the generation of the electricity, the transmission of the electricity, which is from wherever that generation was over long distances, to when it gets down to the neighborhood level, and then you get your distribution level. A lot of the grid failures we're seeing are at the distribution level. And this is caused by squirrels and trees falling on branches. And so they're, and it's an excellent book out there called The Grid, which I highly recommend for diving into more of these details about just how the cutting back of maintenance has led to additional, you know, just increased outages. At any given time in the U.S., about 500,000 people are without power for 2 hours or more. It's a myriad of reasons that are happening, but the problem is they're building up. And, you know, we've heard conversations in, you know, in national politics about our decaying infrastructure. Our grid is part of that decaying infrastructure.
It sounds as if there's a great deal of reason to want every house to be, as you put it, islanded.
Sure, or grid independent. So we can use the grid when it's needed. And part of this is due to the evolution of these technologies, right? So solar has now become so prominent and so accepted, and energy storage is headed that way as well. And so, but it's a proven technology. And really, we like to look to the off-grid, people living off-grid and the island communities as places where those lessons are coming out of to really show how reliable these are. So now you can have as reliable and more resilient power from your own systems than you can have from the grid.
So there's much we can learn from Puerto Rico's current experience.
The lessons go both ways, right? So here in Hawaii, we had a high penetration of renewables that then started to have some challenges for the grid. There, they have almost no renewables. It's 2% renewables. And they're in the same situation in terms of the massive imports of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So the $5 billion a year that Hawaii spends importing fossil fuels is something that we can turn into our own capital, right? Our own infrastructure for generating and storing and using our own electricity, as opposed to having to import the fuel for it. We could generate that from the sun, from the wind, and be independent and cut off that ongoing just leakage of money out of our economy.
Are we moving in that direction fast enough?
Well, I tend to think we're never quite moving fast enough. I feel like we could be doing so much more. And that's really what got our founder, Hank Rogers, was saying, this isn't happening fast enough, right? When the utilities started to push back against all the renewable penetration here, mm-hmm. he identified energy storage as one of the keys that needed to be figured out to enable greater renewable penetration. And so that's what we've been really focusing on, is like, how do we open up this gateway?
And Puerto Rico have been providing a great many object lessons, sounds like.
Sure. And it's, and so it's slow. We would love to see the benefit at the larger level because, what we're doing it in the face of all of the bureaucracy and pushback and uncertainty. We're doing it at smaller scales, right? At individual homes and businesses. So whether residential or commercial, those are kind of islands of pockets of benefit that we're generating. Mm-hmm. We'd love to see it happen at a bigger scale. But what we're able to say is, if that's not going to move forward, we'll do it in the way we'll go where we can, because either way, having these resources on the grid is going to benefit the grid. And some of our customers, they're saying, well, if the grid's down where they are, they're saying, well, I'm going to be totally independent. When the grid comes back up, I can choose to connect or not.
Chris Johnson is the Chief Operations Officer of Blue Planet Energy, a Honolulu-based provider of off-grid energy storage systems. The company spent 6 weeks deploying its systems in Puerto Rico, providing energy equipment training to residents.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer programs featuring camps on robotics and cybersecurity for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
Hawaii's roadways were constructed when sea level rise was unimaginable. But today, our oceanside low-lying highways are already feeling the effects of global warming and sea level rise, and the Department of Transportation is estimating the cost of repair at $15 billion. Marcel Honore has the story in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Marcel.
Morning, Chris. Good to be here.
That $15 billion is over how long a period of time?
Well, that really varies. We could say at least 50 years, mm-hmm. But it could be anywhere between the next 50 and 100 years, assuming that the state sees about 3 feet of sea level rise in that period.
Well, that would I can think of an awful lot of roadways that would already all but disappear in that event, right?
Yeah, we can all take our pick. I mean, we're already seeing it happen on Kamehameha Highway on the windward side, particularly Ka'ava. A couple of years ago, we saw two large chunks of that road get carved out and really choke traffic for about a week. You've got the North Shore. You have a whole swath of the bike lane next to Kamehameha Highway up there. Molokai is getting hit pretty hard. I understand from DOT that parts of the highway heading east on Molokai are down to one lane. So, yeah, we're already seeing it. It's already happening.
How long ago were some of these roads built, Marcel?
You know, I'm not sure, but it's certainly, far enough that they weren't even really, thinking. Nobody had sea level rise in mind when
there was no such thing
constructed. Yeah. Right. So it really wasn't an issue when these were constructed.
But the cost of even a mile or so of roadway, aside from crippling traffic, it's a very high per mile cost, isn't it?
Right. So the $15 billion is based on a preliminary estimate that assumes $7.5 million per mile if you were to have to relocate or elevate or take some sort of step to protect the road from erosion. That could also involve entirely relocating it and relocating it further inland. And as you know, with our topography, that you run into the mountains pretty quickly. So it could also involve tunnel boring, which is extremely costly.
And that $15 billion is based on the kind of financing that assumes that you could just write a check for $15 billion. You're not taking into account the financing cost of an amount that huge, but it's likely that this would be a crippling cost in and of itself, yeah?
Sure. Financing can, you know, always add more to the final price tag, for sure.
Well, when you look at, we still don't really have a final price tag on rail, and this is even more than that estimated price tag, yeah?
Yeah, so this is almost twice the price tag for rail, the current official estimate, I should say, because you never know with this rail project.
Right, right.
But currently construction is at $8.16 billion for rail. The bad news is this is almost twice as much. The good news is, again, we're looking at over the next several decades, over the next 50 years, whereas rail, you know, they're really gunning to try and build that project as soon as they can.
Is there much of a movement in the legislature to secure the kind of financing, you know, anticipate these costs?
So far, not really, not that I can see. They are aware of it, though. And, you know, I talked to Representative Sylvia Luke for this story. She heads the powerful House Finance Committee. And, you know, in her view, they basically put out about $1.5 billion or up to $1.5 billion in capital improvement projects in their 2-year budget cycle. So while they haven't really, it doesn't seem like they've taken really a lot of proactive steps here. They are aware of it, and they are looking at how they might have to incorporate this gradually into their capital improvement program in the years going forward.
Just one of those costs that's getting ready to land on us in a big way. Just like all the others. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Chris.
That was reporter Marcel Honoré with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii, presenting the Honolulu Brass Quintet, performing Bach's The Art of the Fugue and music of Adolf and of the Renaissance, 9th, 17th, and 23rd. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
State lawmakers are taking up 2 tobacco bills today, one making the University of Hawaii a tobacco-free zone, and another to restrict access to e-cigs to those under 21. We sat down with Jessica Yamauchi, Executive Director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute, to talk about why it supports the measures.
The issue is that we are continuing to see our youth use rates rise. It is much higher than our tobacco rates. With the latest Hawaii Youth Risk Behavior Survey, ever tried tobacco products in our state for high schoolers is at 42.3%. And for middle school, it's at 27%. So we're really concerned with how many youth are using these products.
And I know there was a time when a lot of these companies were marketing them with, you know, candy-flavored bubble gum just to make them more enticing, I think, for people to try.
Yes. And so e-cigarettes really don't have those regulations. So they do have all kinds of flavors. They're able to advertise on radio, on television. And they've really become quite popular with the youth. They have different kinds of contests that they'll hold on who can make the largest cloud. They're just the popularity of them is something we haven't seen in many, many years.
And the concern is what? Because there are chemicals that are in these vaping devices, I guess.
Yes. We typically refer to them as electronic smoking devices. But yes, there are many chemicals in them. Most of the time there's nicotine in them. There are many studies that have shown that kids move from vaping to using cigarettes. So that's very concerning. Studies that have found that kids that weren't likely to smoke cigarettes end up using cigarettes because they started with e-cigarettes.
So these bills that are advancing, what can you share with us? What as far as licensing and what you hope to accomplish?
Yes. So we have a bill that's up for hearing tomorrow on Wednesday in the Finance Committee. And that bill does three things to regulate e-cigarettes. The first is it would require all the wholesalers and retailers of e-cigarettes to pull a license and a permit, a tobacco license and permit. Currently, without this requirement, it makes it really difficult for education and enforcement of current laws that apply to e-cigarette retailers to be enforced. And so we need to make sure that we have a actual database of who's selling these products. So by requiring them to pull a tobacco permit or license, that would help with this issue. The second is it would establish a tax on the e-juice in e-cigarettes. Currently, there is no tobacco tax attached to e-cigarettes. They're the only tobacco product that does not have any type of tobacco tax attached to it. The bill that we have been pushing would propose to tax them the same as other tobacco products, which would be 70% of the wholesale price. And this would just be the e-juice that is taxed. And the third thing would be to limit online sales, and online sales would be limited to someone with a tobacco license.
And so right now, then you're basically saying that a lot of these younger kids, like in middle school, are getting access.
Right.
And they're becoming addicted.
Yes. And so anecdotally, you'll hear from students how they obtain access to these products. A lot of times it's through other youth that have gotten their hands on it. Many of them have purchased them online. That's why one of the important components on this bill to limit online sales is really critical to helping with the enforcement of our Tobacco 21 law. You're supposed to be 21 in order to purchase e-cigarettes as well as tobacco products. But with online sales, without the restriction on e-cigarettes, they're able to usually purchase without any kind of issue.
And cigarette smoking or tobacco use has dropped.
Yes.
Over the years.
Yes. We continue to see tobacco use decline, especially among youth. But with the e-cigarettes, the popularity is, like I said, not something that we've seen in many decades. And so it's really concerning. I think the misunderstanding that these are harmless, safe products, I think the marketing that is happening have really worked against the efforts that we've had and successes we've had with tobacco control. And we now need to apply this to e-cigarettes.
So it's really trading one evil for another. It's really the same
right.
thing, just a different method of delivery.
Yes.
And so while you're not ingesting it and hurting your lungs,
you're still inhaling.
There's still some hazard there.
Yes.
So the pushback, I would imagine, though, is for some of these companies saying, you know, hey, you're going to shut down our business.
So our intent is not to close down businesses, but to have regulations in place. Again, all of these regulations are regulations that apply to cigarettes. If you sell cigarettes, you have to pull a tobacco permanent license. There is a tax attached to it, and you can't purchase cigarettes online. So all of these three things in this e-cigarette bill already are applied to cigarettes. And so it's really trying to have the same regulations applied to e-cigarettes.
Had you folks tried to do this before in previous sessions?
Yes, we have.
And what's been the stumbling block?
I think, so we've been working on the permit and license for probably about 5 years now, the tax about 3 years. And each year there's one reason or another that it doesn't quite make it through. I think the tax in the beginning was very complicated, and we were really looking to see how other cities and states were starting to do it. I think now there's more model language that can be used, and I think the desire from the legislature is there that it is time. We have not seen a drop in our e-cigarette youth use rates at all over the last 4 or 5 years. So I think everyone knows that we do need to do something or these rates are going to continue to climb.
Is there a particular state that you're holding out as a model that we can use?
There's several. I'd have to go back to look at which one we particularly modeled our language after. And this would just be for the tax portion. But I could go back and check.
Okay. And then there is other legislation, I think, having to do with public housing and the use of tobacco products. But I understand that there's already some federal law in place?
Yeah, so basically the public housing bill that's continuing to move forward is a housekeeping measure to make sure that our state law is in compliance with what HUD rules now require. So HUD requires a 25-foot distance, and our law currently says 20 feet. So it's just trying to bring that into compliance.
Is there anything else that we're doing to educate our youth?
Oh, absolutely. We have staff that do go and do high school presentations and middle school presentations. We have a youth council that we work with that have been advocating for bills. They worked on a bill this year that unfortunately is going to die, but it was the first year it was introduced, and that was going to create a buffer zone around schools that tobacco and e-cigarettes couldn't be sold within 500 feet of a school. So this was the first year we tried that. But to see the youth get involved and learn about the legislative process, to be passionate about an issue is great, and they then influence their peers as well.
That was Jessica Yamauchi, director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. That wraps it up for today, but we throw it back to Pledge Central with Bill Dorman.